Please be seated. First is up this morning, we have the Temple Home Family Trust, et al., Judicial District Court, and Royal Lawn Owners LLC. Before we begin this morning, Justice Gibbons has a couple of questions just to put out there he'd like responses to as to this matter. And make sure you introduce yourself and the appellant, if they wish to reserve time, please state how much you wish to reserve.
Right. Thank you, Justice Edwards. Yeah, just either side could address this, and you want to do it in your arguments. First of all, we'd like to know what the current status is of the bankruptcy proceeding. Has the stay been lifted? Has the property been foreclosed upon? Has it been reorganized? Just so we know how that calculates into the various issues raised by the parties. Secondly, we'd like to know if NRS 11.350 was become an issue at any time in the district court. That's the statute saying that if there's an injunction issued, perhaps like the 11 U.S.C. 362 stay, what effect does that have on the state, on this other litigation? In other words, can this be stayed pending the outcome of the bankruptcy case? If it hasn't been raised, please let us know. If it has been, I didn't see it raised as an issue here. 11.350. From everybody's looks, I get it wasn't very but anyway, we go through these cases, and there's a lot of paper here, and we're trying to make sure we hit every issue, and everything was raised in the district court then. So
that counsel would have those statutes memorized and wouldn't be cheating with the iPads.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. If you're ready, then please do so.
May it please the court, Frank Flansburg, along with Phil Arbach, Gary Goodhart, on behalf of the petitioners, Ken Templeton is with us in the courtroom today. The question is, does the statute afford guarantors their fair value defenses when a creditor makes an election to foreclose or otherwise enforce their mortgage or lien, regardless of the waiver of the one action rule, and regardless of whether the property has actually been brought to sale just yet? Upon default, every creditor has an election. And that election is if the guarantor has waived the one action rule pursuant to 495.2, they have the option to sue the guarantor straight away and never reach the fair market value hearing and they get a judgment against the guarantor for the full amount. Those are the fusion set of facts. However, alternatively, the creditor has another option to make. They may elect to maintain an action or enforce the mortgage or lien by recording an NOD, then sue the guarantor, and maintain that action, ultimately proceeding to a sale and fair market value hearing. That's the Walter set of facts. Our case, the Templeton case, is similar and parallels Walter's because of this election, the election to foreclose or otherwise enforce a mortgage or lien. That's the significant difference when we walk through the statute. Because as we walk through the statute of 495.3, it's plain and ambiguous. If the creditor or obligee maintains an action to foreclose or otherwise enforce a mortgage or lien, the guarantor may assert the fair value defenses. When we look at the statute in just the plain language, maintains in its simple present tense means something that's ongoing, in the process of. It need not yet be brought to conclusion, such as completing the sale, for the fair value defenses to be raised. Second, we need to know that there has been an action taken by the creditor. Some action, some affirmative action on behalf of the creditor. And we also know it's not just any action. that there must be a certain action that's modified by this prepositional phrase to foreclose or otherwise enforce a mortgage or lien. And what are we talking about there? It's not particularly mysterious. A mortgage or lien, after all, is a deed of trust. We're talking about the remedy of the deed of trust, which are contained at 92 to 94 of the record. We're talking about the power of sale to enforce the assignment of rights, seek receivership, to enforce a security interest in the property. So if there is that maintenance of an action to foreclose or otherwise enforce the mortgage or lien, the guarantor may assert the fair value defenses. And by looking at our case, that's where we find ourselves. Here, there is a default. Then there is an election by the creditor. Unlike foreclosure, there is an election by this creditor to record an NOD against the property and then commence the foreclosure action. That's undisputed. The bankruptcy of the borrower is then filed, and there's an enforcement of the assignment of rents and a plan to give us the property. Excuse me, to give the creditor the property. And then there's the suit to the guarantor. At the time of the suit to the guarantor, a stay was raised concerning the bankruptcy action. NRS 11 was not cited to the court, but the court was provided an opportunity to stay and did not do so. After they sued the guarantor, the creditor maintains its action in the bankruptcy on the deed of trust remedies. They continue to enforce the assignment of rents, to which they've collected nearly $4 million, about $180,000 a month, maintaining that action month to month, and they have a plan that says, give us the property. The creditor is still seeking its interest in the property, as you can see in the request for judicial notice, Exhibit 2, pages 23 to 25. It's undisputed. And we know in the bankruptcy that while it hasn't been brought to conclusion, there has not been a motion for relief from stay filed, but in the bankruptcy pleadings, there's an active effort to go after the property. There's a plan confirmation hearing. The plan, the creditor's plan, is at pages 430 to 445 of the record, and it states that the creditor gets the property pursuant to the plan.
And you sought in the bankruptcy court to enjoin, and I forget the statute, so 362, somewhere in that range, is a part where the bankruptcy court has the discretion to enjoin actions against guarantors pending the resolution of the bankruptcy to avoid this double recovery issue and all your argument. Has that been requested, or what's the status of that?
It was requested and was denied. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because although the position of the creditor in the pleadings before this court is that Chapter 40 doesn't apply, what you see at page 24 of the request for judicial notice, Exhibit 2, filed by the petitioner, is a suggestion that the only thing they're seeking against the guarantors is a deficiency judgment, which requires the application of Chapter 40. So what we look at is, because they've taken this action to foreclose or otherwise enforce the mortgage lien, we get the opportunity to assert our fair value defenses. And the one-action rule waiver does not waive the fair value defenses. What the one-action rule waiver does is it means we cannot force them to make the election to foreclose or enforce their deed of trust. So we could not have made them had they chosen to go down the foreclosure route, which they did not do. They made an election on their own. Second, under the one-action rule, because they have taken a state action against the borrower, bankruptcy, and also sued the guarantor, we could have argued multiple actions and violated the one-action rule and therefore lost the rights to the secured collateral. By waiving the one-action rule, we didn't make that argument. So the one-action rule waiver doesn't address the fair market value defenses. And it's important because the fair value defenses address something very different that's not protected by any other statute in the Nevada revised statutes. And with permission, I'd like to approach the board for a simple hypothetical.
Please.
Thank you. And the question that we face is, does 475 and 485 otherwise protect against a double recovery? If you assume a straightforward transaction, $1 million transaction, secured by a deed of trust and a guarantee, and you presume a default, and there's an election, they could sue the guarantor or elect to enforce their deed of trust. This is the foreclosure route, and this is enforcing the deed of trust. Let's say that they don't go the foreclosure route, they take the route that they did in this case, and that is elect to enforce their deed of trust by recording an NOD, seeking a receivership, and enforcing an assignment of rights. But just like this case, let's presume that they don't yet take the property to sale. Mm-hmm. Instead, They sued the guarantor for a $1 million judgment. And they argue to the court, as they did here, and suggest that fair value defenses don't apply. We're entitled to a judgment for the full amount of the indemnity because the property has not yet been sold. So let's give them that and see how it works. We have a $1 million amount owed on the indebtedness. Then let's say after that $1 million judgment, they enforce that judgment against the guarantor and have a $400,000 writ of garnishment. You would have to add that into the collection and subtract that from the $1 million indebtedness. That would leave still $600,000 in their amount of indebtedness. Let's say they've gotten everything they can get from the guarantor, so they take the property to sale. They had maintained their action on the deed of trust the entire time, and they now take it to sale, and they credit bid. And they credit bid $500,000. So if they credit bid $500,000, the amount that's left over on the indebtedness is $100,000. Now under 485, the guarantor only has a lien on amounts over the amount of the indebtedness after the bank has been paid in full. Under this scenario, there's no recovery for the guarantor. But let's look at what the bank actually potentially received. You have a guarantor collection of the $400,000. That's the same across the other side. But let's say that the property has a fair market value of $800,000.
Counsel, well, also this issue that you're getting into right now, I guess a real issue for us is this is a request for mandamus. What we've had is a partial summary judgment only as to liability. So the question is the second part that you're getting into, the actual liability, which is subject depending to further briefing, is that truly right at this point for us to get into?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And the reason it is because when making an election of foreclosure or otherwise enforced by mortgage or lien, it gives rise to the fair value defenses. So the only thing for which a guarantor or borrower could be held liable is a deficiency judgment. And a deficiency judgment can only be calculated pursuant to the revised statutes of 451 through 4639. So the partial summary judgment on liability or guarantee is inappropriate because the only thing for which the guarantor can be held liable if the fair value defenses apply is a deficiency judgment. No less, but no more. And did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Actually, I appreciate what you're saying, but again, those arguments have not been fully briefed down to the district court. So having us intervene at this point, that's why I'm questioning it.
I appreciate that. And I think that what happened at the district court below in granting summary judgment on the guarantee liability avoids these issue of the deficiency judgment because the guarantee is not what the liability is for the guarantor if the fair value defenses apply. It's the deficiency judgment. So if I may finish this analysis here, if the property is $800,000, the total recovery for the bank is $1.2 million, which is a $200,000 double recovery. The only thing that protects that double recovery are the fair value defenses. That's why they matter. Because 47485 does not look at the fair value of the property. It only looks to the indebtedness. And because the fair value defenses matter and apply to something very, very different that's not otherwise addressed by the statutes, is why these statutes were enacted in 1969 when Justice Gunderson dissented in Manufacturers Traders and had a majority in Shields to protect against double recovery. And that's why the fair value defenses matter and that the appropriate writ should issue to the district court to adjoin those proceedings to allow the fair value defenses to be applied.
Just, I guess, to piggyback on the opening statements made by Justice Gibbons, why is not the bankruptcy court the proper forum to do this in?
Because
the secondary issues.
I'm sorry, thank you, Your Honor. Because the bankruptcy court is leaving the fair value defenses to the state court. And that's what the creditor has argued in their petitions to the bankruptcy court, as we see at Exhibit 2 to the request for judicial notice, that the deficiency pleadings and the fair value defenses are subject to the state court. The guarantors are not even before the bankruptcy court. Does that address your question, Your Honor?
partially because still the bankruptcy court would have some concern as the money's being paid out in a suit, and then who would then be the proper party to receive the property. So I think that is still an issue with the bankruptcy court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's part of the problem here, because if their plan is confirmed, they get the property and the fair value defense is applied. And that's exactly the issue we find ourselves in.
I have just a couple questions. Yes. On Shields, first of all, that was a judicial rule which was subsequently legislatively overruled or modified by the Nevada legislature. So I'm not sure of the applicability now, other than just the historical context you raised. But I want to ask you about Walters. Now, Walters, Justice Douglas authored that, and that was an en banc case, and we did say that in Walters that if you complete the trustee's sale, it kicks in to the Chapter 40 time periods and defenses and all that. Here, though, it's different. You know, they've recorded a notice of default, but they haven't held a trustee sale, which, in fact, I guess one of your clients would have inhibited that through the filing of the Chapter 11, you know, so they couldn't proceed forward. So are you asking us to extend Walters to situations where they've recorded a notice of default and exercised assignment of rents and appointed a receiver and all? Is that your argument? Because I read through the briefs last night and I didn't quite see that. I know both sides discussed Walters, but it was a little vague as to what relief you wanted on that.
I think that's the point, Your Honor. Two things, if I could. Walters, what we're asking Walters to proceed is under 495.3. It's that the creditor maintains an action to enforce the deed of trust. So what we're asking is that Walters address one part of it, but here enforcing the deed of trust, this disjunctive or, must mean something. And enforcing the mortgage or lien, enforcing the mortgage, the deed of trust, is enforcing the obligations of the deed of trust. Therefore, you should extend Walter to make sure that we have our fair value defenses. Second, 495.3 was a compromise post-Shields. And after Shields, the legislature adopted 495.2, but in the AB 557, what you see is to make sure to retain the fair value defenses for guarantors, and that's 495.3. With that, I'd like to reserve my remaining amount of time.
Counsel, we're going to give you 3 minutes because we've got 2 minutes.
That makes my colleague very happy. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
May it please the Court, my name is Ali Marjadehi, and my colleague, Janet Coates, is here with me, as is my other colleague, Merrick Booth. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to appear before you. I would suggest to the Court that the position of the petitioner finds no support in the Nevada statutes, in precedent, nor in policy. And we would ask that the writ be denied forthwith and that the trial court be directed to proceed with adjudication with dispatch, because the pendency of this writ has had the practical effect of freezing the trial court for approximately a year. Let me start with the statute. And we believe that the beginning point of analysis, Your Honors, is the one action rule. And the one action rule in 40.430 expressly contains exceptions. Those exceptions pertain in 6A to the appointment of a receiver, in 6E to the exercise of a power of sale, in 6K to any proceedings in bankruptcy. Those are completely and expressly built out of the statute. In addition, the one action rule 40.430 expressly pulls in the guarantor protections under 40.495. which indicates in subsection 2 that has no application where there has been, as in this case, an express waiver of the anti-deficiency non-action protections. But let's focus then on precedent. So the statute is clear, and it internally is consistent, and the readings, the tortured readings given here, does not find really a home in the statute when read in context. Recently, in June of this year, the Federal District Court here, in the Bank of the West case, and we filed approximately 10 days ago with your honors our supplemental pleading.
Which we read all of that, so thank you for that.
Certainly. But that case is very clear, and counsel who's ably arguing today was counsel in that case, and the arguments basically that are being made here were rejected. This is the same argument that was rejected there. And what does the Bank of the West hold? It holds that the recording of a notice of sale does not constitute maintaining an action. And that's, of course, consistent with the definition of what is and what is not an action that appears in 40.430. And, of course, Bank of the West cites this court's unpublished decision in Feruzan. And in that case, this court dissects the statutes very well.
But we can't rely on that case. It's an unpublished panel order. Also, I believe I did read the case because you cited it, and even though I wasn't on it. And it's in that case, the lender never even started a foreclosure, you know, on the borrower. It was just a direct suit against the guarantor. So it's factually different than this one.
Agreed. And the reason why we believe that legally that distinction doesn't make a difference is because the one action rule says filing a notice of sale is inconsequential because it is not an action. And it makes common sense. These statutes and the whole fallacy behind the arguments being advanced and the false premise here is whether or not there's a sale. So long as
concerned about a double recovery in this particular case, and tell me why not if you...
That's, and I'm glad you asked that question, because absolutely not. Because the statute is designed to prevent, as you noted, a double recovery, and there can be, by definition, no double recovery where there hasn't been a foreclosure. We do not have the property. The borrower still has the property. The borrower is still pulling management fees from the property. The borrower that's an affiliate of the guarantors filed the bankruptcy. So on the one hand, they have sought bankruptcy court protections. Now they're running to this court and essentially saying,
the stay is lifted.
Well, to go to the status of the bankruptcy, they have proposed a plan where they propose to rewrite our note non-consensually. We have proposed a plan, and under our plan, we either get the property back or we go to a foreclosure sale. And in either of those events, if we get the property back, we're not going to be entitled to a double recovery. If we get the property back, the only argument that would remain in that context is whether the value that we received by virtue of the property exceeded or was less than the debt.
We understand that. Here's the problem. Let's say we deny the red, do what you ask. And in order to mark denying the red, and Judge Bear, I guess is the judge in this case, he sets a trial next month. and the bankruptcy case is still plodding along and you're battling over who can confirm what plan, you go to trial, you establish your damages, you know, like that. It hasn't been liquidated yet as far as what the value of the property, because there's been no trustee's sale or you haven't taken it back. So we're in this kind of gray area where you've been exercising the assignment of rents and having a receiver. It sounds like an accounting nightmare, you know, for the court to sort out. So how do we deal with that?
Your Honor, you know, it was the guarantors who signed the guarantee in order to get more than $32 million. The way it would play out is, and we do have a motion for a separate judgment pending, the way it would play out, in our view, is that we would get a judgment. And it would play out similar to the way Bank of the West that we cited played out, because in that case, indeed, there was a judgment. And then there was a foreclosure. And what you would do is, we can't, you know, get the judgment for the full amount, get the property and say, you know, we're going to collect for the full amount. The only thing that would be left at that point is really going to the state board and them arguing, which I anticipate they ably will, that the property that we received at the time has a value greater than the debt, and we will be arguing the reverse if, in fact, the valuation supports our position. So you will essentially have a valuation fight, but that valuation fight is looking at, again, the difference between the value at the time we take title and the amount of the debt.
It's just like a deficiency judgment.
Exactly.
Hearing.
Right. That's exactly the point, and that makes common sense.
Okay.
And also, you know, just to, you know, underscore how these statutes work equitably, at any time, Mr. Templeton, who has vast resources, can refinance and pay us off and keep the property. That's always an alternative available to the guarantors. That is not taken away. There's nothing here that prevents the guarantors from going and refinancing, paying off, keeping the property, and we're all done.
How are you accounting for the exercising your assignment of rents? Are you applying the rents towards the post-petition interest payments or what? How is that being processed since you elected to exercise that?
Well, ultimately, under the guarantee, what we would do is we would just take an accounting of whatever is accruing under that, and the amount of the rents would be deducted in the overall calculation. So it would be really no different. I mean, there is no difference in terms of the ultimate outcome under the guarantee, because the guarantee basically says we get whatever is owed under the note, and that's the way it should be. Plus, you know, all the costs that we have had to incur through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is not going to be any windfall. I keep sort of asking myself, you know, how could we possibly get a windfall? And I'm having a hard time. And frankly, you know, the hypothetical presented was too complicated for me. I didn't follow it. But in my simple way of thinking about this, there is no way that we can get a windfall. The people who are getting the windfall is the folks who are holding on to the property, not honoring their guarantee, and essentially, for the past year, we've been stymied in state court by virtue of a writ that we believe, again, has no legs under the statutes, under precedent, or under policy. And we ask
you, have you asked for a trustee to be appointed in the bankruptcy court?
No, Your Honor, we haven't asked for a trustee to be appointed. We have proposed our plan, and the matter is under submission by Judge Nakagawa. And again, no matter how that plays out, that's the important point that I wanted to make sure that I communicated. No matter how that plays out, that really does not impact what happens. Either they keep the property, alternative one, and then we get a full judgment and our guarantee that we will enforce, or alternatively, we get the property and their exposure on the guarantee is going to be reduced by the value of the property. It's as simple and as straightforward as that, and you know, we're not going to go to any court and seek double recovery. That's not what we do. That's not what the law does. It's sort of a mirage to keep harping on these folks are after a double recovery. That's just not anywhere in the law, as far as I can see, and we don't see it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please, the court. Phil Arbach, I'm going to do the reply. Is that okay? To talk about the bankruptcy deals with the debtor. It doesn't deal with the guarantor. Totally separate. That's why they could proceed against the guarantor. So we can't push this back into the bankruptcy on the guarantor side.
We understand that. We also understand it will have some effect as to who retains the property. And the question we're looking at is potential double recovery with moving players involved.
Correct.
So we understand the dual litigation, and we're concerned as to how this second portion, or the first portion, that simply said the guarantor is responsible, but the operative issue is how much.
Right, but let me take that away and go back to liability, which was your first question.
Back to what he broached and proposed to us was almost the fact that you would have your defenses available if a writ is not granted. So why is that not true? Explain that to us.
Here is why that is absolutely not true. Is because all of this is non-judicial. What our statutory scheme under 495.2 and 495.3 is that it's judicial. There's a judicial deficiency hearing if the fair value defenses apply. What he is saying is we foreclose on the property and we get the property, we'll figure out what the fair market value is, and we'll sue the guarantor. Now we're talking a $36 million or $38 million judgment they'll have against the guarantor, and they'll get the property, and there'll be no judicial supervision of that process. That's the problem.
So you were saying, Mr. Auerbach, that if it's different than if the borrower is having a deficiency hearing, because you can contest the fair market value at the time. If it's different, you can challenge what was bid in at the trustee's sale, where you can't. You're saying you can't if it's guaranteed. The guarantor can't do that.
Correct. You cannot. If they sue the guarantor, get a judgment. So now they have the full amount. That's what the partial summary judgment was on, is on the guarantee, which is incorrect if the fair value defenses apply. And if they got a full judgment against the guarantor, then they foreclose on the property, they've already got the full judgment on the guarantor. There is no hearing. There is no hearing that they initiate under 457, 459 to have a deficiency established. They've already got the full amount, and it will be up to us, up to their good graces on how much they deduct from the fair amount. This double recovery is critical, but the reason that analytically their theory doesn't wash is analytically, what is this liability for? What was granted in partial summary judgment liability? Are you liable on the contract, guarantor? That's what they want. What really is, there's no liability in Shields. Justice Gunderson said, there's no liability until you determine the amount owed, you have the deficiency hearing, and you subtract the fair market value, then you decide whether there's liability. Under this process, there is no liability for a deficiency conceptually, because the liability is the amount owed minus the fair market value. What Judge Baer did is entered partial summary judgment on the guarantee, a breach of contract. Conceptually, that doesn't make sense. If you go into a deficiency hearing, what elements do you prove? You prove the amount owed, You prove the fair market value, and you prove the amount it sold for at the foreclosure sale. And then the court has to make a deduction, and that's the amount that the statute says you have to enter a deficiency for. There's none of that on Judge Baer's partial summary judgment on the guarantee. That's why it has to be reversed. And what we've got is a simple, very simple statutory interpretation in this case, which is under 495, under 495 subsection 3, if they've been maintaining an action to foreclose, it's really simple. If they've been maintaining an action to foreclose, which is notice of breach, suit for a receiver, which is enforce the assignment of rents, and continue to enforce the assignment of rents and file a plan, 495 subsection 3 forces fair market value defenses. That's what it does. Now, this case is kind of...
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
Mr. Abak, of course, your opposing counsel said that it's all fine and dandy, but under the law, a guarantor can waive this, and there is a signed waiver here, and I think he's arguing, didn't say it, but we'd be legislating to override what the legislature says if we did this interpretation. What's your response?
He made a mistake. He said that we waived the anti-deficiency defenses, which we did not waive. What we waived and what can be waived is the one action rule. And as you'll recall, the one action rule says if you start an action against the guarantor, your deed of trust is void. Remember, component systems, the deed of trust is gone. So to waive the one action rule, you lose that penalty, so you can go ahead and sue the guarantor. The real issue, gentlemen, is when can you go to trial against the guarantor? And ever since Shields, NRS 40.457 has said that you have one hearing where everybody's present and we determine the fair market value. Gunderson said it in Shields. There hasn't been a change in that law since then. They have to wait. And why do they have to wait? Which is they're so sad about. They're sad because they chose to maintain an action. And do you know what? You want to know something even more significant? Is they bought this note in deed of trust, and they bought it after the notice of default was sold. They bought it after.
Well, does that matter? I mean, it's.
Well, they came into it. It's not poor me. They came into it with their eyes open about.
We have a lot of supposes, and we're getting outside of what was argued. I've given the leeway at this point. If you have an unclosing thought, give it to us, and we're going to end this right now.
This ought to be reversed because there's no liability on the guarantee because fair value defenses apply. Simple 495 subsection 3, no question of fact they've maintained an action to foreclose or enforce their lien.
Counsel, I'll be sending kind of one brief thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. What Mr. Auerbach said in terms of us getting the judgment and then foreclosing and then not having recourse is wrong. And it's wrong as explained by the court in the Bank of the West case. On page 2 of that case, the court there says very clearly, if plaintiff elects to foreclose on the collateral property subsequent to attaining the judgment against defendants in a personal suit, defendants are entitled to a fair market value credit. That's bank of
okay, let me ask you this, because this is very important. This case is over, if I may, just, I'm sorry we're dragging this argument on
him,
but are you stipulating today, I want to get this clear, that if you foreclose on the property, you make a bid at the trustee's sale, that they can challenge that bid. They can go in there and say that that's not the fair market value as of the date of the trustee's sale. Yes or no?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So they can contest what they believe the fair market value is, and the judge will have to sort that out. You make your case, they make their case.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Counsel, I'll give you the last word because you're entitled to it.
None of that matters if you follow the statutory proceedings. None of that matters because that means a guarantor who's already got a $36 million judgment against him has to go in, file a lawsuit to challenge it, whereas the normal procedure is you sue for a deficiency. You're going to give them, if you don't reverse this, you'll give a $38 million judgment against the guarantor when there hasn't, when there's clearly evidence that they've been maintaining an action to enforce the lien, which puts it under 495 subsection 3.
Okay. Can I ask one quick question? I'm sorry.
Do we have a marshal here that can have him taken out?
Limitation on the guarantor's liability apply. What is? How does that come into effect at all? There was an amendment that apparently limited the liability on the guarantee.
I'll have to let my other counsel. The limitation, that amendment was removed when the borrower filed bankruptcy, so it's a non-issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. This matter is going to stand submitted. I think, counsel, for the spirit of argument this morning.
This is a very interesting issue, as both parties are aware of. With that, thank you very much. This matter stands submitted.